The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events. Isabel Allende has been here so many times that I have actually lost count. Why has she come so often? You know why. Because we love her. We love her passion, we love her honesty, we love her intellect, we love her stories, we love her warmth, we love her style. We can't help ourselves. Amamos a Isabel. Tonight, our guest will be interviewed by Philadelphia's own Janet Benton, author of the much-praised novel, Lily de Jong. Please welcome back to the Free Library, Isabel Allende and Janet Benton.
The novel we're here to celebrate is called In the Midst of Winter, and it brings three very different characters together. Lucia Maraz is a 62-year-old visiting lecturer who lived through the military takeover of Chile. She's living in the basement apartment of her colleague, Richard Bowmaster, a 60-year-old American human rights scholar at NYU whose parents were Holocaust survivors. Evelyn Ortega is a tiny, stuttering woman who fled Guatemala after gang violence took her two brothers. She has become a nanny to a boy with autism. They become involved in a situation together. I'm guessing many of the people here tonight would like to know how these characters and this story came to you.
How the story came to me? Bits by bits. I started all my books on January 8th, and on by the holidays of 2015, I had rented a brownstone in Brooklyn where I was spending the holidays with my family and a couple of friends. And somebody asked, what are you going to write on January 8th, the day I start all my books? And I said, I really don't know yet. But by January 7th, I hope to have some idea. So everybody started giving ideas. And I picked up some of those ideas that resonated with me. For example, one of the ideas was given by my daughter-in-law, Lori, who runs my foundation. And we have been working with immigrants and refugees for a while. So she said, you have to write about refugees. And somebody else said, write about me. And he's a scholar in NYU. And then I remember that I have a brother that is also an academic. Weird people. So... So that's a great character. My brother is vegan and he has four cats. I mean, that's perfect for a book. But you know, life is so strange that we were yesterday in Princeton and I said that I had a character that was vegan with four cats, and then the director of the library came forward and said, I'm vegan with four cats. Now, what are the odds that that can happen? I mean, really. I got sidetracked. What was the question?
That's great. You've told us where the story came from.
What brought them together? So I had these three characters, and I had, of course, a woman. I needed a female protagonist, and I thought of someone that would be in her 60s, who has gone through a lot of losses in her life. She's divorced. She has gone through breast cancer. She lost her mother. And she has come to teach a course in NYU, and she likes Richard, the landlord of this brownstone, and her boss at the university. But he's not available. And she has these romantic ideas, as I do. I'm 75, but I'm always thinking romance and sex. So I thought she would be too. Being Chilean, probably she would be too. So I brought them together. I needed something to happen. And at that point, when I had started the book, there was a blizzard in New York. I mean, you remember the blizzard last year in January when everything was paralyzed by the snow. Perfect. That's exactly what I needed. And so I decided to have my characters trapped for 3 days in the snowstorm in this house in Brooklyn. And that's the story. Well, there's more to it. There's more to it.
In the Midst of Winter shows the struggles of undocumented immigrants and the terror of extreme repression and brutality. Lucia says, "The law is cruel and justice is blind." What do you wish more people understood about the experiences of those who must leave their own countries?
Well, I would like people to not think in terms of numbers, but in terms of individuals, names, faces, stories. We tend to think 68,000 kids cross the border. That's a number. And each one of those kids means something. It's a person with a story. No one leaves what is familiar to them, their home, their language, their family, everything they know, everything they have, to go to another place where they will be received with hostility and aggression unless they're running for their lives. And refugees all over the world. Refugees are people who are desperate, and we fail to see that. There were no Syrian refugees a few years ago. Why do we have millions of Syrian refugees in Europe today? Because of the circumstances in their country that forced them out. We wouldn't have Central American refugees today if it was not because the circumstances in their countries are so bad that they have to leave. And responsible for that state of affairs is a history of genocide, of exploitation, of abuse, and CIA intervention to prop up the worst kind of government in those countries. So it is important to understand the causes of this and think that it's not a wall that would stop them. What will stop them is trying to solve the problems in the countries of origin. You know, when in 1973, when I left my country after the military coup, thousands and thousands of Chileans went to Venezuela, where we were well-received, and we found work, and our families prospered there. Now, because of the situation in Venezuela, thousands and thousands of Venezuelans are going to Chile. And Chile has become a country that is stable. It has political, economic, and social stability, and is receiving all these people. So it depends on the circumstances in the countries of origin.
Yes, yes. Thank you. Your work gives great importance to the pasts of your characters. In this novel, healing occurs as the characters share their painful stories. This need to share one's stories comes partly from the dislocations the characters have experienced. Does this apply for you too as a writer? Are your novels in part the fruit of exile?
I don't know if they're a fruit of exile, but my first novel was an exercise in nostalgia, in longing. I was living in Venezuela, and I was beginning to forget my country, my family. And then on January 8, 1981, my grandfather was dying, and I started a letter for him to say, I remember the stories you told me, I remember the family. And I wrote about a fictional family that was exactly like mine, to the point that several members of my family have not spoken to me to this day. And that little micro world of the family reflected the macro world of the country. So it's 70 years of history of the family and the country. I would not have written that book without exile. But when I write, I think of a character, immediately I think what happened in that character's life. For example, I wrote The Japanese Lover, I think a couple of years ago, and my characters are 80 years old. My first question is what happened in the 80 years of these people's lives. The most important thing that could have happened was the Second World War that affected the female protagonist because she was Jewish and the male protagonist because he was Japanese. He was in the internment camps in the United States. So that determined their fate in many ways. And for me to be able to write a story, I need to know everything about the past of the character.
Yes, I remember reading in Paula, I believe, that That was a habit you developed working on plays early
on. Yes. I wrote a few awful plays when I was young. And we would be working with the actors. And the first reading is around a table, usually. And each one of the actors reads their part. And then the work begins, because the actor needs, even if the actor will be on stage for 5 minutes, he or she needs to imagine everything about the character in order to make that sentence that will be said on stage believable. And I apply that now when I write.
One of the themes of this novel to me seems to be forgiveness. Lucia forgives Richard and wants him to forgive himself for some terrible things that happened in his life. I found that hard.
To forgive oneself?
Yeah, to forgive
him. Oh, it's so much easier to forgive other people than to forgive ourselves.
Yeah. I guess I'm just interested in the way that exploring one's past might involve forgiveness. Is that each of them has a past that's...
It's very traumatic.
Yes.
The title of the book comes from a quote by Albert Camus that says, "In the midst of winter, I finally found within me an invincible summer." And I imagine three characters traumatized by their past who are living in an emotional winter. And they are stuck there. And when they begin to tell their stories and share their experience and they open up and they take risks, they find solidarity, compassion, friendship, humor, and eventually the invincible summer. So the idea that in sharing our stories we learn to forgive each other and to forgive ourselves also, because we realize that at least most people have not done anything that is so awful that cannot be forgiven. I mean, I'm talking normal people, not psychopaths. Yeah, or politicians.
You grew up feeling hampered by the limits placed on girls and women. In your novels, you create worlds in which women's connections and power are often paramount and have saving force. Has writing these stories been satisfying in this way?
Well, I don't know any other stories. People say, why do you always write about strong women? I never met one that isn't. So I don't know. And my job is to get people to talk and tell me their stories. And I find that connection of sharing our lives really important. Today I got a letter. I get a lot of letters every day, and today I got an email from a woman that just lost her daughter. She was 23 years old, and she drowned in San Diego. And she writes to me, and she said that she's desperate. She doesn't know how she's going to survive her broken heart, and how did I find joy again in my life? And the only thing that I could tell her was, get out there and share the story. Talk. Don't isolate yourself. Because when you start sharing, you realize that everybody has losses. And we somehow get back on our knees and keep on living. But if we close ourselves, like Richard does in the book, and you never forgive yourself and you never open up to the losses of other people, then everything seems eternally dark. It's an eternal winter.
Throughout your work, especially in painful moments, the ghosts of loved ones offer great comfort to the living, and there's quite a lot about the persistence of the soul or the spirit after death. Do readers write to you of their own mystical experiences?
No. They don't. They think that I make up those things. And actually, I don't see ghosts, but I feel the spirit of my daughter. I am in touch with my grandmother. I am in touch with my daughter as I am with my mother. My mother is 97 years old. She lives in Chile. We communicate daily through email, but I'm not with her. I'm not seeing her. It's the same with Paula. I'm not seeing her, but I'm communicating with her permanently. So, of course, I do believe that there is much more than the material world in which we live. But in the United States, people don't think that way. But everybody consults astrologers and psychics and therapists. Everybody has a therapist.
Well, I think that's something very beautiful about your work.
What, the therapist?
No, that that continuity between the dead and the living. And in all your work, you do take on these big issues of living and dying. Your characters often experience renewal as well, a rebirth of hope, curiosity, and desire. And I think that's a part of what makes your life, your work so deeply moving, is that you take on life's big questions. Do you think this is a part of why you write, to be able to explore these questions?
I write only about certain things. And I've been writing for 35 years. I have 23 published books. And I look back at my life as a writer, and I keep repeating certain themes. Certain things just come back: strong women, absent fathers, violence, death, love, loyalty, redemption, organic justice, which is all not the same as the justice of the justice of department. I mean, Department of Justice. And I find that there are themes that are always in my writing. I suppose that if I was more aware of it when I start writing, I would try to avoid it and explore new things. But that's what I care for. I couldn't possibly write a novel about Wall Street, but I can write novels about a Guatemalan immigrant or about people that I can connect with.
In Paula, you say that your tata, your grandfather's stories alone could fill your lifetime of books. Has that shifted for you in recent years? Do you feel like you're drawing on I guess, partly living in the United States for as long as you have?
Well, they say that there are only 12 stories in the world, and all the rest are variations of those 12 stories. And I suppose my grandfather told the 12 stories because I can find different angles to those stories, but it's always about the same things. Like Shakespeare, you know, that it's all about the fundamental, the deadly sins and the fundamental obsessions of humankind, that you find them 500 years ago as valid as today, and are they the same in Finland or in Brazil? It's the same.
I'm glad you brought up Shakespeare, because I know, or I read, that when you were young, you were given the complete works of Shakespeare, which you devoured.
Because I like the writing. I like the stories. I mean, who's there? What's there not to like? People who eat their children. I mean, it's just fantastic.
So it is. It's really quite wonderful to read about you know, the books that happened into your life and had such a big influence on you, including that falling apart copy of 1001 Nights hidden in your stepfather's 3-section wardrobe that you secretly read at the age of 14. In your memoir, Paula, you write, quote, "On those pages, love, life, and death seem like a gamble. The descriptions of food, landscapes, palaces, markets, smells, tastes, and textures were so rich that after them the world has never been the same to me." To me, this describes the wonderful experience of reading your work. And I wonder, nowadays, when you start to read a book by someone else, what are you hoping to find?
Connection. I want to connect to the story and surrender to the story. The few times that I've been teaching, very few times, or when people ask me, aspiring writers ask me for advice, I can't give any advice. But if you're a writer of fiction, the only thing I can say is that your first responsibility is to make the story believable. You're writing fiction, supposedly it's a pack of lies. But those lies have to be fundamentally true. They have to be founded on something that is very good research to begin with, and sentiments and events that are real, so that people can connect to it. And without that connection, you have the kind of literature that is very entertaining, like crime novels or romance novels or vampire novels that are great, but you cannot surrender to the truth of the story. You know that you're just being entertained. And that's not the kind of book I write. So I need to make it believable to the reader, which is hard, because fiction has to be believable, but reality seldom is.
Are you aware of layering in sensory details into your work, which is part of what makes it so believable?
The details?
Yeah, the sensory
details. I love the
details.
I love, and when I read, I want to find details too. Not because I want to learn something, but because it brings it to life. And when I was young, very young, reading 1001 Nights, we were living in Lebanon at the time. And girls in Lebanon didn't have any social life. We went to school and we were at home, and this was in the 50s. I'm really old. I look good, but it takes a lot of money. And I look good from a distance. Don't get too close. But in Lebanon, when I was really young, reading these books, of course I was, with a flashlight, I couldn't mark the books because my stepfather would have found it. So I was always looking for the dirty parts. And so I was jumping from one story to the other, but I would get caught in the details, in the fascinating detail of the description of fabrics, of textures, of flesh, of the smell of the fruit in the market. That was fascinating. And I think that in a way has permeated my writing. And it came back to me in Venezuela. I left Chile after the military coup, and Chile was a sober country in winter at the time when I left, that was living at least half the population in terror and in a very repressive government. And I landed in a few hours in this country, in Venezuela, that was the second richest country in the world after Saudi Arabia because of the oil boom. And everything was abundant. And there were mangoes lying on the street that you didn't have to buy them, you could just eat them. In Caracas, there was more champagne sold in Caracas than in all of Europe. I mean, it was just, everything was like the 1001 Nights. So when I wrote The House of the Spirits in Venezuela, I think that all that abundance of Venezuela permeated the book. And although the book is about Chile, it has that texture that I got there.
And that's what in your work demands surrender of the reader, is that level of detail, that when you sink into it, you do really believe what's going on. Despite the seriousness of your work, it does have its funny moments.
I hope so.
And in the midst of winter, you write of the character Lucia that, quote, her Chilean irony was untranslatable. I wondered, that made me think about your own work, of course, being written in Spanish and being translated. Do you suspect that some of your humor doesn't come across in translation, or have you long given up on worrying about that since your work is now in 35 languages?
I don't worry at all. I mean, who knows what is translated into Vietnamese? Chilean humor is like Jewish humor, really tough, and it's not politically correct. So, of course, it's not translatable in the United States, where everything is so politically correct that we live in a very boring world. So my translators have to tone it down, and then when I read the translation, I go line by line. I call the editor and I said, they missed this. And she said, well, it doesn't sound good here. So I know that sometimes you have to adapt the book to the other culture.
Have you ever had an instance of that where something quite surprising was changed that you learned about, or no?
No, I have heard that in other languages things have been changed dramatically, but I have not been able to see it because I can't read the language. I was told that in Japan, Paula was a boy, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure.
That's a pretty big change. You describe yourself as writing from a deep, quiet place of dreams, visions, and free-flowing stories. Do you also revise from that place, or is there a different experience when you're revising?
No, it's totally different. First, I research, and that is very pragmatic, and I try to be as detailed and accurate as possible. I have written several historical novels, and very seldom I have had a historian complaining, and historians are watching, because I'm really careful with the research. And then I try to tell the story from the belly, not from the brain. Let it be, let it flow. And then the editing and the correcting time comes, and that's also, that's very cerebral. It's different.
I have one more question, which I think you already said you don't have answers to, but and then we'll open up the questions to, for everyone else. What advice do you like to give to writers?
To aspiring writers? Very few, because everybody writes in a different way. This is a creative process, and creativity happens in very different ways. I was listening some time ago to Anthony Doerr, who wrote All the Light We Can't See, and he was talking about his creative process, and he was rambling, talking about this and that, and I said, how is he going to put this stuff together? And at the end, you realize that all this he has been talking about are the pieces of the puzzle that allowed him to create the wonderful book that he wrote. And so I got a glimpse of how his mind works, but every mind works differently. I think that my mind works in circles and spirals, never in a straight line. So I can't have, for example, a script knowing that I'm going from this point to this point. No, I just go around and around, and sometime the circle starts getting smaller and smaller until finally I sort of get the story. I would say to aspiring writers that this is like training for sports. You train and you train, and nobody cares about your effort or how long it took to train until you can play the game and perform. And that's the only thing that counts. And in writing, it's the same. You're not going to write the great American novel in one sitting. You train and you write and you write and you write until maybe, if you're lucky, one day there is a draft that you can show to somebody.
The other possibly thing, covered with soup.
Yeah, yeah. The other thing is, be merciless. Cut what is not working. Don't save what you have cut because it's not recyclable. It won't work in another. If it didn't work there, it won't work later. And I would say, don't show your work around because it gets stale. If you talk about it too much, if you show it around too much, then you get a lot of opinions. And you start telling and telling, and you never write it. And if once you have a good draft, then try to find an agent, because otherwise it's not going to work. But nowadays, the publishing industry is really hard.
Thank you so much. And
thank
let's
you.
Open it up to audience folks.
Hi, good evening. Thank you. Buenas noches. Soy chilena.
Gracias. Just,
thank you so much. I've seen you all over the U.S. on the East Coast when I've been here. I've been in the United States now for 17 years. And I wanted to ask you, as a Chilean as well, how do you stay current on such a small country that, I don't know, you're one of our best. You are one of our best, you know, representatives. And so when I was dating, my now husband wanted to know more about me, so I lent him one of your books. And so I said, you know, just read her book, and then you'll find, you know, we're sort of like this. so I lent him My Invented Country. But I wanted to know, like, how do you stay, what message do you have for Latin American women in the United States? How we can make our voices heard, and how do you stay current on Chilean, you know, yeah, issues here in the U.S.?
Well, I would say that I keep connected because my parents are alive. My mother is 97 and my stepfather is 101. God, they are immortal. My mother has wanted to be a widow for the last 10 years. But unless we help a little, it's not going to happen. I'm connected with my mother daily. She writes to me every single day by email, and I answer every day. Then I save my letter and her letter. And by the end of the year, I have a box where I put all the letters in chronological order. I have a storage room full of letters for decades. And each letter contains between 600 and 800 letters, each box. So you can imagine it's two lifetimes in writing. So that keeps me connected. Plus, I go to Chile often. And I'm aware of, in big strokes, not the detail, of what's going on politically and otherwise in Chile. Now, the second part of your question about what would I say to Latin Americans that live here as immigrants, that you don't have to choose. You can have the best of both places. Don't give up your language, your traditions, your customs, your family, your memories, because you don't need to. You can get the best of this country and the best of what you brought with you and have a very rich life.
Buenas noches, gracias por estar aquí. One of my favorite of your books is Cuentos de Baluna, and I was wondering, I'm hoping for another book of short stories, but whether that experience was different, writing short stories as opposed to novels.
You know, I've written only one collection of short stories, and I doubt that we'll ever write another one. It's very difficult. It's so much easier to write a novel than a short story. A short story is like an arrow. It needs direction, speed, precision. It's like poetry also. You cannot waste anything. Everything counts, and everything is visible. You have to know from the beginning of the story how it's going to end. There is no time or space for rambling. A novel is like a tapestry that you embroider with threads of many, many colors, and you can make mistakes and nobody notices. In the richness of the pattern, they are not noticeable. So I prefer the novel because it gives me time and space to go back and forth and to redo and to rewrite and to think things over. With a short story, you can't.
Buenas noches. I grew up in the Amazon in Venezuela and Colombia, and you're one of the only writers I've ever read who captures people as people who are indigenous in the Amazon, and I was just wondering what your process was for that.
I wrote one book, a young adult novel, called City of the Beasts, that is placed in the Amazon. I had been in the Amazon a couple of times, and researched a lot about it. And I thought, I will never be able to write about this place. It's just so alien to me, so complicated, so incredibly magical and fantastic that I can't write about it. And then many years later, many years after the trip, when I was planning a young adult novel, automatically the Amazon came to my mind because it was the perfect setting for an extraordinary adventure of a couple of kids that get lost in the Amazon and end up with an indigenous tribe. When I went to the Amazon, one of the times I went, one tribe that had never been contacted before had recently been contacted. So there was a lot of information about everything, the way they live and everything else. So I did a lot of research. And I always assume that people are people everywhere. No matter what the cultural differences, no matter where they are, we are people. We all want the same things. We all fear the same things. And we all want love. We all want respect. Why would the indigenous people from the Amazon be different?
I've traveled all over the world, and Chile's one country I've never been to.
You should go to Chile.
Well, I've discovered Chile through your eyes, and I'm actually going in about 5 weeks.
Good for you.
So how would you recommend that I discover the Chile that I have seen through your eyes?
Oh, you will be disappointed. because the Chile I wrote about is the old Chile. My book, My Invented Country, is a memoir about my invented country, the country that in my mind exists, the country that was my country when I was there. But 40 years or more than 40 years have gone by, the world has changed, the country has changed, and we have all changed. But still, Chile is very hospitable, very beautiful, and great food, great wine. And I think it's such a wonderful landscape, from the Atacama Desert, the driest desert in the world, to Patagonia in the south, that you will have a good time, I'm sure. Over just there? Don't say that you are from an agent of the CIA, and it will be fine. Fine.
Over there.
Hi, I'm from Italy, and I read your first book when I was 14 years old, and now 14 years later, I still love your book.
Thank you.
Here, I've read all your books, and here I see people from all ages. And what do you think is the reason of people of these different ages love your books, like me or other?
You know, I don't know. As I go around in these book tours, I realize that people are getting younger and taller. It's not a good feeling. And as I said before, I think that what connects people to my books is that I write about what happens to all of us. I mean, I write about human stories, relationships, connections, and the stories that we all, in one way or another, have lived or will live. So maybe that's the connection. And I also have good publishers and good translators. Probably the translations improve my book.
My last name is Allender, and the most common mispronunciation is Allende, and it's the one I never, ever tell them is wrong. Your work that has been my favorite is your memoir. I love memoir, although I'm looking forward to reading this. And I'm wondering how you feel about writing memoir as opposed to writing novels, if it touches you differently, and if you enjoy it as much, because I can hear in your voice how much you love writing novels.
Well, writing a memoir is very different. Very different. And I have written memoirs more out of need than anything else. My first memoir is Paula. And I wrote it at a time when my heart was broken after the death of my daughter. And that book allowed me to put together all the confusion of that year when Paula was ill, and make sense of it, and get through the first year of mourning that was really bad. And the second memoir, written like 10 years later, I wrote because many, many people asked what happened to the people that appear in Paula, to Paula's husband, to her brother, and what happened to them. And so I wrote a second memoir called The Sum of Our Days. And then after that book, my son made me swear that I would never write again a memoir. Because, of course, in a memoir is not only about me. It's about the people who are with me in life. And have I the right to write about them, to own their stories? You know, we all have stories that we tell about ourselves, and other people who know us will tell the same story differently. So it's all very subjective. A memoir is very difficult to write, and the way that I have tried to sort that complexity is that when I write a manuscript, when I have written the manuscript, I show it to the people who are mentioned by name in the book and see if they accept the way I have portrayed them. And in The Sum of Our Days, my stepson, one of my stepsons, who had been using drugs for a long time, didn't want to be in the book as a drug addict. And I couldn't change that fact, so I just took him out, because I realized that, of course, I had to respect his wish not to appear as a drug addict in the book. And unfortunately, some years later, he died of an overdose. But at the time, it was understandable that a young man would not want that. So I don't think I will write another memoir. Now that I have a lover in my life, people keep asking me, oh, how is it to be in love at 75? As if I was sort of in my last stage. Yeah, like in hospice. And I keep saying, I am. It's like being in love at 17, but with a sense of urgency, because you don't... Exactly, you don't have time. How many years will I have to enjoy Roger? 5, maybe 10 before he's demented. I know I will not be, because my mother is not and I have good genes, but I don't know about him. But so people say, you have to write a memoir about this. What is there to write? Two old people in bed? Is that what you want me to write about? It doesn't look good from the outside. So I don't think I'll write a memoir about that.
Good afternoon. My name is Gretel Cuevas. It is a pleasure to meet you. So as you mentioned, many of your characters are inspired in people you know. So I was wondering, what is the quality that you value most on people?
Well, I value for real life a lot of qualities, but in my books, I can't choose people who have common sense. They don't make good characters in books. Yeah, because nothing happens to them ever. I like crazy people for the books, not to live with them, of course, but in real life, what I like, there are several things I like very much: kindness, good intention, humor. I like people who like animals also, for some reason. I like intelligence, but not in an abstract way. It's the intelligence of catching what is in the world, curiosity, enthusiasm for life. All that is important to me. And if it's a male, I hope he will be also sexy. It's not necessary, but it's a good trait. It's not often that you can find someone in their 70s, though, that is sexy. Not maybe Harrison Ford? Maybe.
Hi, my name is Carolina Lopez. I actually got introduced to you by my mother. My mom is a huge fan of yours.
Thank you, mother.
So I wanted to know, how was the experience of bringing one of your books to a movie in the case of The House of Spirits? And will there be another book turned to a movie?
Well, the experience of The House of the Spirits was wonderful. I was not asked anything about the script or the cast. The movie was filmed in Europe with a total Anglo cast, so it had a bad rep in the United States because many people complained that why didn't they give a chance to Latino actors if it was a story placed in Latin America. But even so, I liked the movie very much, and the movie gave a new dimension to the book. Many people will never read the book, but the movie has been around for 20 years. Now the option is gone, so it's terminated. So I'm already getting calls to make a remake of The House of the Spirits. That would probably be absolutely different from the first one. And then there is another movie of Love and Shadows that was made in Argentina with a Latino cast. And that was, in my opinion, a good movie, but it never had the impact of The House of the Spirits. Because at the time when that movie was made, 20 years ago, Hollywood would not invest in such a big production if they didn't have big names. So Meryl Streep, Jeremy Irons, Glenn Close, Vanessa Redgrave, all of them were in the movie, and they created this enthusiasm about the movie that would not have happened without them. Now things are different, and you can make movies that are not in English and not with very famous actors and still be successful. I have had options for other books like Daughter of Fortune and others, but the contracts now, the movie contracts have changed. And first of all, there's no termination to the contract. They're forever. So you sell the right forever. That means that if they don't make the movie, no one else can make it. And forever, no one can. Then they want the rights to do everything with the option. They can do animation, they can do a musical, they can do whatever they want. Plus, they want the copyright of the characters, which means that if I write about my own characters, I have to pay them a royalty. I can't sign that.
Hi, I'm from Buenos Aires. I emigrated here when I was 4. When I was 19, it was the only time I went to Chile. I was in Santiago. I went with my grandmother from Buenos Aires. She had a funeral, and I went to visit my best friend here who was studying abroad in Santiago. And I had this very unique experience where this 70-something-year-old woman that my grandfather had trained with, who was an orthodontist, was very fascist. She came from a military family, and she was driving us around, and she took us to Pablo Neruda's house, which was so strange for me, the contradiction. But so my grandmother, everything she said, I was like almost vomiting. But my grandmother was looking at me in the rearview mirror like, don't say
anything.
She's doing us a favor. So it was like very difficult for me. But I guess my question is, what do you do when you encounter people like that from Chile, if there's anybody you're in touch with like that, or here, that just kind of make you vomit when they talk, but you also understand that they have a story and an experience that affected their family. So, yeah, that's it.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you bring that up, because the military coup happened in 1973, a long, long time ago. And still, Chile is a polarized country in many ways, because the scars of the dictatorship are still there. And the last person who experienced the repression of the dictatorship needs to die before we can turn the page and say, okay, this is ancient history. The military dictatorship would not have lasted 17 years without support of a part of the population. I would say one-third of the population, at least. And to this day, many of those people still believe that the dictatorship was good for Chile, that it forced people to work, that it organized the country, that it avoided a socialist government or whatever. My best friend is one of those people, my best friend in Chile, Pia. That has not affected our friendship. She understands me and I understand her. We come from different backgrounds and we experienced all that period differently. She and her family benefited. Me and my family had to leave. And yet we can talk because we have a lot in common and we love each other. So when I see what's happening today in the United States, it breaks my heart. People are not talking to each other. There is this abyss that is getting wider and wider, in which we simply ignore the other side. We don't want to hear what they have to say. And how are we going to get to an understanding, to change things, or to work together in those issues that are important for the country if we don't talk to each other? So I'm not, of course I don't like Trump, of course. But that doesn't mean that I can't talk to somebody who does. I can. I vomit in the bathroom, but I do talk. Yeah.
Hi, hola. Soy Paola Weber, soy la sobrina la Pia.
Ay, qué linda mi tía.
Bueno, two things. First of all, what is the reason you start your books January 8th? And the second, what happened is you don't have a story and January is coming up. Did you freak out?
Well, I'm still thinking of Pia. I'm sorry. Sorry, I started my books on January 8th because I started the first one on that date. And it was a lucky book, so I started the second one on the same date and then the third, and now I don't dare change it. Because if I do, something horrible will happen. Also because of discipline, I need to carve the time and the space and the solitude to be able to write, and that's several months in the year. What was the other part of the question? If I don't have a story on January 8th, well, I'm screwed. But that doesn't mean that I don't show up in front of my computer. I get there and I just wait and try this thing and that thing. I usually have a vague idea of a time and a place, but I don't have a story. I don't have the characters. That will happen in the next few weeks. I never give up. It's like love, you know? I like a guy and I never give up. It helps to be so stubborn.
How about over there? Good evening, my name is Angie, and I was born and raised in Costa Rica. Your work is some of your work is actually part of the school curriculum. We read your short stories, for example. I think it was the first one I ever read. And we always knew, since we were little, who Isabel Allende is. But now that I look back at Latin America, authors and writers, most of our most famous and loved writers are Pablo Neruda, Pablo Coelho, El Gabo. But there is one name of a woman that always persists, and it's Isabel Allende. How have you managed all these years to make it through a world made for men, and through a world that is mainly known for our biggest men writers?
Well, thank you for the question. I do not belong to the boom of Latin American literature that started around the 60s and ended around the 80s. There was a choir of male voices that told the world about Latin America, and they wrote about, they also gave us an image of who we were in Latin America. And when I wrote The House of the Spirits, it was said then that I was the last one and the only female of the Latin American boom. According to other reviewers or critics or professors, I don't belong to the boom. Thank God, because they're 10 years older, so that's good. And many of them are dead already. But it was hard, because you need to do double, triple the effort to get half the respect and recognition if you do. It has taken me 30 years to be respected in Chile as a writer. I am the most well-read writer in Chile by far. And still, people wouldn't say that I was a writer. They would say that I'm a narrator, a storyteller, or whatever. It took the national, I got finally the National Literary Award that is given every 4 years to a writer. And when I got it, finally, people said, they couldn't deny the fact that I was a writer. You know, it's been very hard, not only because I'm a woman, but also because I sell books. And so people tend to think, I mean, reviewers and academics tend to think that if you sell books, they are commercial books. It's a great underestimation of the reader. It's assuming that readers read trash only. And that makes me really mad. Also, it makes me mad that a young guy of 19 can write his memoirs and get reviewed, and a woman who has been writing for 35 years has a hard time getting reviewed. Still, I like being a woman. I don't know what I would do if I was a man. I mean, with that little capricious organ, what would you do with it? Where do you put it? It's terrible. I mean, I always imagine it must be so hard.
I really enjoyed your novel about Zorro, and I was curious about how you came to write a book using a pre-existing character and what that was like and what inspired you to write that.
Well, Zorro has owners, a corporation called Zorro Productions, and they came to me years ago And they said that they had done everything with the character except a work of literature. And because I had written young adult books, historical novels, I'm from Spanish background, and I live in California, I would be the right person to write the book. And I said, look, I don't write on commission. But then I remember Antonio Banderas on the movies, and I thought I'd give it a try. But everything had been said about Zorro, everything. I mean, would you create another adventure? So I thought, okay, let me imagine a boy, what happens in the life of a boy to become Zorro? And so that was my story. And I had a lot of fun writing it because at the time when Zorro supposedly lived, nothing was happening in California. There were big Mexican haciendas, and it was a territory of a few tribal people that in small tribes that didn't even communicate with each other. So it was a land where it was you couldn't place an adventure there, but everything was happening in Europe. It was a fantastic historical time in Europe, especially in Spain. So I took my character to Spain. And the adventure happens mostly there, and then at some point he needs to return to California. So I had him, well, the only way of transportation was by ship. So he had to come back. And the villain had to be here before, but the villain left after him. So how did I solve that? Well, the Pirates of the Caribbean, of course. They kidnap Zorro, and they keep him in New Orleans for like 3 months. That gives me enough time to move the villain rapidly to California. And then I got fascinated with the Pirates of the Caribbean because, of course, I had to research for that. And I thought I will write about that, and I will place my story in New Orleans. And I researched about that. And when I was doing that research, I realized that that was not the story I wanted to write. I wanted to write about why New Orleans became this French place. And it was because 10,000 refugees left Haiti during the slave revolt and came to Louisiana. So my story starts in Haiti, in Island Beneath the Sea. And it's a story about slavery. And all that happened because of Zorro. So you never know. And I did get to meet Antonio Banderas, by the way.
Well, good evening. It's a pleasure to...
this lady over there also. Hi.
It's a pleasure to listen to you.
Thank you.
Like you, I have a solitary profession. I'm an artist, so I'm all by myself. Do you have a schedule for yourself? I mean, what happens on January 9th?
What happens on January 9th?
Once you begin, do you write all day? Do you use a computer? Do you have a long-term? Do you look at it long-term and say, I hope to be finished by such a time? Or how much do you write all day? Do you write every day?
Well, this is my job. Yes, I write every day. And I write better in the morning than in the evening. So I write during the day. I write at home now. Before I used to write, I have a room or a place where I would write, but now I can write at home. And I write every day many hours. It's with certain discipline, but always with joy. I don't have to force myself. It's really great. Really great. And once I get started, it's like it starts moving. It's like dancing. You can't stop. Now, Roger is coming to live with me in December. I'm terrified because my house is really small. It has only one bedroom. And I live there with my dog. And now I will have this man living with me that I love, by the way. But how am I going to write with a presence around? I don't know. It's going to be hard. No, I write on the computer, always. I can't write by hand anymore.
And this is the last question, I'm sorry.
Is it the last question?
That's
okay.
What I was instructed, yes.
Yeah. Make it good.
No pressure.
No pressure.
Señora Allende, I'm from Puerto Rico, and we have an altar for you there.
Yeah.
Thank you. I must be the happiest woman here tonight because it took me 7 years to see you.
Oh, thank you.
And why 7 years? I spent quite some time in a combat zone, and one of my friends sent me La Isla Bajo el Mar. And Baila, Sarite Baila, it lasts for me in my heart forever.
Take the microphone closer. Yeah.
Yes, and La Isla Bajo el Mar, when you start writing Baila, Sarite Baila, it's just still in my heart.
Aww.
And your book maintained me, my sanity level. So your magic.
Why do you say you were in a combat zone?
I'm a combat veteran.
Okay.
I was in Iraq for a year and a half.
Yeah.
And thank you for that. And I believe that you have been saving many of us. And please always remember Puerto Rico and all of
I
you
do,
as well.
I do. I love
thank
Puerto
you.
Rico. Thank you
thank
very
you.
Much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.